This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and this show is called The People Behind the PhDs. This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and welcome to part three of the interview with Dr. Robert Poole, who studies corpus-aided discourse study, corpus-aided language teaching and learning, and ecolinguistics at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. There's an overlap of about 10 seconds, so we can pick up right where we left off in The People Behind the PhDs. Stories. Stories are humanity's original technology, so I'm proud to carry on the traditional technology and share this story with you. Whether you're on an iPhone or an Android, whether you're on Apple, Spotify, or another podcast service, whether you're at home, in your car, at work, on public transportation, working out, or just walking around, I dedicate my shows to you. Dr. Z Productions and Podcasts, Consequential Stories for Life.
Traveling. I don't know if I actually like traveling. I love living in different places.
Okay.
So just living in this neighborhood, developing relationships. I love that. I love that I was a teacher at this school and that I had a neighborhood and a community.
So you,
and I just thought that I would try to continue that.
So you don't like the getting from A to B. You like once you get to B, you like that, the developing the relationships and exploring the world through living somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, traveling and the tourist life is exhausting. I don't necessarily want to go to the local museum. I want to go and sit at the cafe and then go back there again and again, and then they know my name and they know what I want to drink, right? Like, I like to develop those relationships and just immerse myself in a place.
Got it. So what, after Guyana and the Peace Corps, did you go right back to Alabama or did you do another adventure?
I accepted a job at a location out west to work at this sort of youth camp. Drove out there, didn't like it, returned. Got a job at the University of Alabama, actually, where I have returned to today. But within months, I was so anxious to go. I was so anxious to move. I was saving every dollar that I could. I was just living such a frugal existence, just to save every dollar. So I worked this job. I was an admissions counselor, and it was good. It was fine, but it just wasn't the right time and place for me. So within months, I remember being called in by my, supervisor. He wanted to make a plan on this new initiative. And I just said, I think I'm quitting. I am quitting. I'm gone.
Was that your...
I bought the one-way ticket to Panama.
So that was your thought process. I think I'm quitting. In fact, I am quitting. Was that the conversation?
Well, I knew I was quitting.
Okay.
I just thought... Yeah, the delivery wasn't so smooth, but there was no way I was going to be there for weeks more or months more to carry through this initiative. So when he proposed that to me, I just had to say, how about I just quit in 2 weeks instead?
Okay, so then you were on the first flight to Panama. What were you going to do in Panama?
Well, I sold everything. I sold my car. I sold everything I owned. And I basically just had a backpack. And I flew to Panama. I was going to meet a friend there. And the idea was I'm going to travel north from Panama City, Panama, and find a place where I want to live. And as soon as I stumble into that place... I don't know where that will be. That may be Costa Rica, it may be Nicaragua, it may be Guatemala, but I'll find it. And when I do, I'll figure out something. I'll figure out how to make this work and live there.
So it sounds like there's a transition in your thinking. So a couple times earlier in your life, you had this very clear idea. I'm going to be in this country lifestyle in Guyana. You're immediately put into an urban environment. So the second time around during this adventure, now you're just like, I know it when I get there. So you're thinking it's sort of modified at this point at the outset of the second adventure.
Yeah. I think I could have never done some of the adventures that I ultimately did without the Peace Corps, without the structure and security they provide. And I love the Peace Corps, and I would encourage anyone to join. But after the Peace Corps, I had the confidence to just go out and solve it on my own. Peace Corps volunteers will know there's a lot of bureaucracy. There's a lot of things you have to abide by, so many rules. So after that, I was like, you know what? I don't need an organization. I know what I want. And I know the world is not so scary as maybe I once imagined. And I can just go get it. And so I did.
So where did you end up as you headed north from Panama through Central America?
Yeah, so great times in Panama, great times in Costa Rica, but I stumbled into Granada, which is just this beautiful town in southwest Nicaragua, and loved it. It was amazing. Beautiful city. I got a place. You know, I was living in a hostel for a week or so, and then I found a volunteer organization where I could start teaching some English classes. And then I saw this language academy one day, and I just walked in and said, hey, I would love to teach. Do you have some classes that I could teach? And they're like, yeah, absolutely. Come back on Monday. We'll have some classes for you. So within a month, I had a job. Now, it wasn't paying very much. I think I was getting paid $2 an hour.
Wow.
So I think I could basically pay my rent. I was paying $200 a month for a room in this shared house. And each room had different volunteers from around the world. I had roommates from Australia, France, England, kind of a revolving cast of characters. And over time, I would meet other families, and people hired me to be, you know, sort of a private tutor to their child. So I sort of pieced together different teaching things, tutoring, teaching at this school. And I ended up living there a year. I loved every moment. Again, Granada's amazing. Just great people, great culture, great music, great food, just a great scene. But after a year, that need to move came back.
Well, what about the $2 an hour? Did that influence you at all, or is it just really like I need to just do another adventure at this point?
Oh yeah, I was broke. I was absolutely broke. I wasn't, you know, sustaining. A very frugal existence. I still probably needed $500 or $600 a month to live. And I wasn't really getting close to that. Maybe my best month, I was getting $300 or $400. I would do some house sitting, an expat who would go back to the States, or I would live with a family for a short time, or even at one hostel, I bartered and said I would teach lessons for free, English lessons for free to their kids if they just let me rent a room for really cheap. But it wasn't sustainable.
At this time, let's hear from our sponsor. This People Behind the PhDs episode is sponsored by Harp Concepts. Are you an up-and-coming artist with a bright idea? Are you a startup company who needs to prove your concept? Or are you a person who likes to personalize special gifts? Harp Concepts makes high-quality 3D models for a fraction of the price of big-name companies. Learn more at harpconcepts.com. That's harpconcepts.com. Then what's your next adventure? So then from this Granada, Nicaragua, where did you go?
So I had a friend who was teaching English in Korea, And I connected with her, and she was telling me about it. And I thought, well, that sounds great. I think I want to do that. So I started interviewing. I started applying to schools in South Korea and doing interviews. Obviously, the time difference was hugely different. So I remember doing interviews. Like, I remember one time being at a phone booth at like 2 a.m. on a street in Granada, talking to a school in South Korea.
So this is before Skype and a lot of the things we use now.
Yeah. I mean, there were internet cafes, but they weren't open at 2 or 3 a.m. So I just remember getting a calling card and making some calls. And so the school decided to hire me. So I flew to D.C., picked up a visa, and got to South Korea in the middle of the night, got picked up and dropped off in this small town in the center of South Korea. Didn't know anyone, didn't know what I was doing, didn't know anything, didn't really have much money, I was broke, but just started piecing it together again, and yeah.
So what did you end up doing in South Korea? You were teaching English?
Yeah, teaching English again. So I ended up being in South Korea maybe 2.5 years or so. And I think that was where I started to, like, to that point, teaching was just a ticket to travel. It's just, where can I go to next? I'll teach here. I'll save some money. I'll go. And I just imagined that lifestyle continuing. Like, I knew people in Korea who were quite successful teaching English. They'd have a few months off and they'd do some traveling and then come back and teach before just going off again. And at that time, like, Korea was sort of almost backpacker circuit, where you could show up, you could make decent money teaching English, and then, you know, after a few months or after a year, you know, you could just go off on your next adventure. So it was well known at that time as this kind of pit stop to make a few dollars before going off again.
Okay. And so that was your goal. So what was there an event that changed things? Because if you have this go idea, show up, figure things out, what kind of changed? Was there some critical moment where you thought, I could really do this professionally?
Yeah, I think there's both a personal and a professional. Like, on one side, like in the school, like I started to see myself as a teacher. Like I started to, like, oh, I'm a teacher. That's what I am. And I would like to get better at this. And, I started to need to describe grammar and language with kind of increased levels of complexity. And I really enjoyed it. So the teaching became more professionalized. But then also I met who would become my wife. And so both of those just sort of entered into decision to return to the States and go to grad school.
So where did you return to? What did you want to study? What were your thoughts? I mean, just to return to grad school, did you want to study English, or what were the ideas about what to study?
You know, at that time, I was still very keen to do international education, international development. So I applied to a few different programs in that area, international ed. But then I did apply to a few places in TESOL and applied linguistics also, thinking, yeah, you know, I could get that master's in teaching English to speakers of other languages. And then maybe I could return to Korea, go abroad again, but be able to get a much better job this time. Like this time with this piece of paper, maybe now I could teach at the university level in a language institute. So ultimately I just decided to return to and get an MA in applied linguistics, and the University of Alabama was the destination. it wasn't necessarily the plan. I suppose there was part of, like, I hadn't lived in the States or near my family in 6 or 7 years, so that was appealing.
So Tuscaloosa and Alabama are kind of a boomerang place for you. You've kind of come back and forth to your home at different points in your life.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, it is. So I came back and got the master's, and, you know, but certainly at that point, I still wasn't thinking PhD. Like, PhD was still not part of the vision.
So how, just for listeners, how old were you at this point? 27, 28, or?
Yeah, maybe a little older. Maybe I was like 20. Yeah, no, maybe you're right, 28, 29.
So this is fascinating. So I think this is important for some listeners that if people don't do PhDs. I think there's maybe an assumption sometimes that someone at a very young age was very smart and they just went straight through and they did this PhD. And there's no way I could ever do that thing. And you, you know, you have a very adventurous life at this point, and you had still, even doing the master's, you wanted a piece of paper to get a job again, but you still had no big plans to do research, which I think it's a fascinating. That's I just wanted to stop. It's fascinating because I think it's important people know that, you know, doing PhDs or doing a higher degree doesn't come quickly or naturally. It's just it's fascinating. But go ahead. So you had this piece of paper. Master's degree.
I'm in this MA program, and I'm starting to just see the academic life. That year, there was this major conference that was going to be in Atlanta, which is just a few hours away. My advisor, just recommended, oh, you should go to that conference. It's a great conference. I think you'll really enjoy it. So I thought, okay, I'll drive over for a day. I'll check it out. But then just went to that conference and absolutely loved it. I still remember some of the talks I heard that day. And that was really inspiring. I thought, I could see myself here in the future. I could see myself as part of this community, talking about this topic, pursuing this more deeply. So just going to that conference that's really where it changed my mind. And I thought, I think I'm going to do a PhD.
What was the name of the conference?
Yeah, we've called it AAAL, but AAAL stands for the American Association of Applied Linguistics.
Okay.
It's this great conference.
And what talks stood out at that point?
Well, specifically the talk I remember is by this professor, Diane Larson Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
Who, later I would come to know is a very influential figure in the field. But at that time, I didn't really have that knowledge. And I just remember her talk was in this large ballroom, and there were these large screens around the room. And for the duration of her talk, on each screen were flocks of starlings in flight. And it was sort of mind-blowing to me, this analogy she was making about chaos theory and dynamic systems theory. And it was just so profound and provocative. I still talk about that event, that experience, to my students. I was talking about it just recently, actually. And I actually saw her speak two summers ago in Brazil. And she has a new provocative video that she shows. And so a decade later, she's still sort of blowing my mind.
So this is 2008 or 9 that you're doing the master's and then went to this conference in Atlanta. What year was this?
2009, yeah.
2009,
maybe, okay. Yeah, maybe 2010 now. Maybe it's spring 2010.
Okay. So then at this point, then you're like, okay, I do want to do a PhD because you were so inspired at this conference. But what exactly inspired you? Obviously, it was provocative, but what led you to the path to make the decision, I now want to do a PhD? Did you feel like you had something to offer, or was it you wanted to get certain training? Like, did you have, very specific thought that led you to say, now I want to do a PhD?
I suppose I always had this idea that my experiences or some sort of sensibility that I would cultivate through those years overseas would somehow inform you know, this person to be or whatever my career might be, that I was going to bring those experiences to whatever I chose to do. And I suppose that conference and the field I was studying, it just seemed like the perfect kind of meshing of my interest in travel and culture and language and teaching. So yeah, I do think, like, you know, I've lived overseas. I've taught in so many different settings and contexts that I do think that I have something to offer here. I do think I have some unique, you know, experiences or insights. You know, maybe that is not terribly accurate. I mean, I suppose a lot of people who enter this field that I'm in have similar international experiences. But at that time, I certainly felt that I'm going to be able to bring that experience, and that's going to inform what I do, and that will have value.
Okay, so did you return to Alabama then with sort of renewed focus and start applying immediately? What was the process then?
Well, I think I decided I would write a thesis instead of do comprehensive exams. I decided I would start looking for places to publish and present. So I published a small book review and a newsletter. I presented at a local conference and then later at a larger conference. I wrote my thesis and sliced it up into a journal article and got it published. And so, yeah, so I guess I went to that conference in the spring, and maybe 6-7 months later, I start actively applying for graduate programs, PhD programs.
Okay. So which ones did you apply to, and which ones were you accepted to?
How could you ask such a thing? You're making me tell you all of the many rejections here.
Well, you don't have to mention the rejections.
Well, I do remember one specifically.
Okay.
I'm not going to tell the name of
That's
the
program, fine.
But I do remember that they emailed me a rejection, then they mailed a rejection letter. And then just for a good measure, a few weeks later, they followed up with another rejection letter.
Wow.
So I do call that one quite specifically.
So they very much wanted you to know. They really wanted to inform you of their decision.
Yes, absolutely. So I remain well informed of their choice. But yeah, so I ended up going to University of Arizona. And I had this interest that was emerging in corpus linguistics, but I'd also... You know, I still had that background in international education. I'd taken some language policy classes, and I'd read this language policy orientations from Richard Ruiz in a class with John Petrovic. And these were two important figures in language policy. And Ruiz was in Arizona. And so he was sort of a connection there. It's like, oh, you know, this language policy person is there. The SLAT program, Second Language Acquisition and Teaching PhD program, the interdisciplinary quality of that program was really appealing. So I thought, oh, you know, in SLAT, I can continue this interest in corpus linguistics, and I can pair that with my interest in language policy. That'll be the perfect place to make that happen.
So tell everyone what corpus linguistics is.
So corpus, from the word, you know, a large body. So a corpus is simply a large collection of authentic language, right? So actual language that has been used by speakers or writers in a true communicative setting, right? So, for example, a popular corpus, the corpus of contemporary American English. It's about 500 million words organized around some different parameters. You can search language in the news, fiction, spoken, different magazines, just various things. So yeah, so corpus is a large collection of language, and then corpus linguistics is the idea, well, shouldn't we base our theories and claims about language on actual language use, which, you know, seems rather straightforward, but that's actually a really contentious issue in linguistics, right? You know, Chomsky's comments and claims on language are largely based on introspection. So in a sense, corpus linguistics is a reaction to introspection as a means to make claims about language. So corpus linguists, we want data. We want to find patterns. And from those patterns, we want to make our claims and statements about language use.
So is another way to say corpus a database of words?
Yeah. I think that's reasonable to say a database of words. It's searchable. So you can search for particular words. It's oft-tated, right? So if you want to search for a particular group of nouns, or you want to search by a pattern of verb plus a particular grammatical item. So it's been tagged and annotated in ways that make it searchable so that you can focus on particular patterns.
Okay. So back to University of Arizona, you decided at that point you're getting more interested in corpus linguistics. And that's ended up what you focused on during your PhD studies, because I also see in your background sheet that you have an interest in ecolinguistics. So how did you go from corpus linguistics to ecolinguistics? What was that connection during your PhD?
Yeah, so corpus linguistics, generally what I was doing with corpus linguistics was studying language in particular contexts or specialized settings. So an early study I did was I looked at letters to the shareholders from Fortune 500 companies before, during, and after the recession, right? So looking at patterns on how they talked about performance, who got the blame for failings, and who got praised for success. So at that time, I was using corpus linguistics to explore business writing, just various forms of writing, various forms of communication. And so then I developed this interest. There was a contentious mine, a copper mine that was going to be built in southern Arizona. And I thought, well, it'd be really cool to look at the language of the environment, to look at how people talk about this environmental issue. Right? How do different groups represent nature? How do they talk about this mountain? And so from there, I sort of just stumbled into ecolinguistics. So I suppose I generally say that corpus linguistics is perhaps a method that I apply to various discourses or texts. And then ecolinguistics has been this sort of theoretical framework for the study of environmental communication.
So someone who hasn't heard those words together before, theoretical framework, can you break that down into, like, for a freshman, let's say, if you had to tell a freshman, what does that mean, theoretical framework?
Yeah, so ecolinguistics, the idea of ecolinguistics is let's perform linguistic analysis on the study of environmental text, right? So when you find a pattern within environmental communication, how do you make sense of that pattern? So you can interpret that pattern through the theoretical framework, right? So beyond simply saying, oh, hey, look at this pattern, it occurs quite frequently, you can instead say, well, look at this pattern based on this sort of analytical framework. This is what it's doing. This is what it means. This is how it's operating within this communication.
So tell us then what you found when you analyzed this mine in southern Arizona, what different groups were saying. You said there was sort of a pro, I read this previously, a pro group and a group that was against the mine. So kind of summarize for us what each group was saying about the mine and nature and so forth in the environment.
Yeah, so not so surprisingly, right? The pro-mine group and the anti group, speak about the issue rather differently, right? It was interesting to see how one group presented nature as a resource to be exploited for economic gain. And within that discourse, there was no discussion of the jaguars, the beauty, the space, of any of these environmental issues, right? Just on what is present in the ground, how can we get it out, how many jobs, tax revenue, how much tax revenue, et cetera. So a very resource-driven way of perceiving the environment. Where the anti-mind group, they spoke about different kinds of trees and the different kinds of wildlife, and they talked of washes and trails and this rather kind of poetic use of environmental language. And so their discourse was very much about stewardship and sustainability. And you could see that patterning just throughout their communications.
What kind of is interesting for me, and I'm thinking for as a person who maybe hasn't heard these things before, and you indicated as such, so it's not a surprise that an anti-mind group and a pro-mind group would think differently. And so that's, a lot of people would say, well, duh, you don't need a scientist to tell me that. But I think what you're kind of sharing is that even if we, as just regular humans and kind of paying attention to the world, can guess at the differences, what you're really exploring through corpus linguistics is really getting at the differences and how they come across. And that's part of the science you're doing, is really capturing the reality through the collection of words and the collection of discourses. And that's where the science really comes in your case, that, yeah, you can all guess at the correct answer that people disagree, but that's not really getting into any depth. I think that's what is coming across in your research. It's really a research of how this really works and how there are really differences. Would you think that's an accurate summation for a person who wouldn't know this research at all?
Yeah, so I think corpus linguistics, what we're generally trying to do is find patterns that would not be noticeable or would not be observable perhaps through other methods, right? Like maybe you wouldn't, through a close reading of a text, you might not be able to discern these kind of underlying patterns that are present. And even if you did notice them, to quantify them would be extremely difficult to do, right? So one pattern that I noticed was one group said project and another group said proposal. So just from that word choice, like project sounds like something that's happening, that is taking place, that is inevitable. Proposal is still tentative. I can still challenge it. It's not said. But from those sorts of keywords, there were other kind of connected patterns that would emerge. So just the whole presentation of how the environment was viewed just changed rapidly and quite sharply based on a few patterns that I think without corpus linguistics, you wouldn't be able to find, to identify, to extract.
Okay. Well, thanks. So we're still at University of Arizona, but I think you shared a lot about your research in that segment. So you finished your PhD at University of Arizona studying, using corpus linguistics and studying ecolinguistics, so studying these discourses around a mind, but that you were able to use in other ways. What did you do after University of Arizona?
Yeah, so my first position after I finished my PhD was as a visiting assistant professor at Texas A&M University, Corpus Christi.
Now, where's Corpus Christi? Corpus Christi.
Corpus Christi, South Texas.
Okay.
2-3 hours south of San Antonio on the coastal bend, so all the way down on the coast. So I had that position for a year. But that transitioned into a tenure track position. So I ended up being at Corpus Christi for 3 years. I was still doing some of the ecolinguistics work there as well. I've always had this, this secondary, well, I shouldn't say secondary. I mean, they're of equal interest to me, but additional research in how I can use corpus linguistics in a language learning classroom. So at that time, I was working on a book, on this project on, you know, how could language teachers use these same techniques at times to explore language on their own, to maybe find their own insights about language as a learning tool, as a learning resource. So, at that time I was doing a lot of work in that area as well.
Okay. And then eventually you moved on to University of Alabama for a tenure track position. So for someone who doesn't know the term tenure track, what does that mean?
Yeah, so tenure track means I'm on path. If I do everything properly, if I publish, I have strong teaching records, I'm presenting, I'm contributing to the mission of the department, that in 5 or 6 years I will be reviewed and a decision will be made. And if I get tenure, I'll get the promotion to associate professor, which is, you know, a really big deal in this world, and it's very high stakes. And, you know, it's certainly, you know, publishing is, you know, it's definitely something that I enjoy doing. I enjoy the research, but it's certainly, like, that's my focus these days is research and writing and publishing.
Excellent. So just two more questions. So for a person who's thinking about doing a PhD or just a master's someday, what would you tell them? Do you have any sort of advice or just sort of general thoughts?
Yeah, I would say just, slow down and curate experiences, collect experiences, and let the MA and PhD come to you. You know, when I meet undergraduate students who just express with such, like, certainty, like, I'm going to get a PhD in this, and they're 20 years old, I just say, that's great, but, you know, maybe go study abroad. Do something exciting, have an adventure, create some experiences and memories, and don't feel that you have to race into a PhD in order to be successful. And I finished my PhD, I suppose I was 35 years old, and so that's fine. You don't have to finish your PhD at 25, 26, 27. So just, you know, take your time. And I even think more programs are expecting people to come to their PhD with some world experience, with some life experience. So don't feel that you have to know the path upon graduation from your undergraduate degree. You can breathe, you can live, take some time.
Are you saying you're not breathing or living now?
Yeah, that's not what I meant, Zach.
Okay.
I'm just saying, that you don't have to go full speed ahead, undergrad to graduate to PhD. I love the research I do. I love the teaching. But I don't think my research or my teaching would be quite as good if I hadn't had the experience that I've had, right? Like every day in my linguistics class, I'm giving an example of, you know, maybe it's Creolese from my experience in Guyana. It's an example of Korean from my experience there. But it's also examples of, you know, from spending time in Southern Africa, et cetera, right? I think I bring that, like, kind of sensitivity, awareness, intercultural knowledge. I just think I wouldn't be the researcher, the writer, the teacher I am, if I had just raced right through it all.
Excellent. So the final question is this. So I'm going to read off a couple of names of famous Roberts. And I want you to tell me the Robert you feel is most, you're most like. So the first Robert is Robert Downey Jr. He's a movie actor. There's also another movie actor, Robert De Niro. There's another Hollywood person, Robert Kardashian. He's a lawyer. And then the final Robert is Robert Griffin III, a football player. Which Robert are you most similar to of those four?
Is none of the above a choice?
Well,
I don't
you
know.
can make that choice if that's what you feel is appropriate.
Well, Robert Downey Jr. has made some questionable decisions, has definitely made lots of mistakes. I guess he's back on path. There's definitely part of that that resonates with me. I've made my mistakes, but I think I'm generally on a pretty good path these days. Robert De Niro. I'm not feeling anything connecting with De Niro. He seems much tougher than I am. Robert Griffith, the football player, I don't even know who that is. The third
He won a
person,
Heisman for Baylor
Kardashian.
University.
When I think Robert Kardashian, I think of David Schwimmer in the OJ series. So I'm probably gonna go. I'm not gonna say Kardashian. So yeah, I guess I'd go Robert Downey Jr., the Iron Man.
All right, so there you got it. So thanks, Dr. Poole, for being on the program today, and we'll talk to you soon.
Great, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to part three of the interview with Dr. Robert Poole, who studies ecolinguistics at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. To continue listening, visit drz.net/download. That's drz.net/download. You can also follow me on Facebook at Dr. Z Podcasts and Instagram at drznet. As always, happy deciding. The People Behind the PhDs is conceived, written, produced, and edited by Dr. Z, that's me, Zachary Brooks, PhD, in Dr. Z Productions and Podcasts. Learn more at drz.net/about. That's drz.net/about.